Let's begin with a bow. Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
You see, you've got quite a list of things here. Don't be overwhelmed yet. We're just going to take things step by step, but I'm the kind of learner that it's hard for me to listen all the time and get the threads of what someone's saying. So I'm more visual. So in a way, I think for me, I try to teach in a way that would work for me. So it's an extra, it's an extra aid if it's helpful. So tonight, this is again module 4, and this is the second class in module 4. We called Module 4 the Foundation of Buddhist Study. And last week I talked about actually study and practice. Oops, we need another chair. Okay. Yeah, maybe by Adam. There's room if you just squeeze me over there.
Thanks.
I don't have another handout for you, but it's online. It will be online when Michael gets back.
You can print it out.
You can share it.
My neighbor.
Okay, great. So last week we talked about practice and study and the importance of study. And the other thing I talked about a little bit was about lineage. And the third thing was on the path as it's laid out through the Tibetan Buddhist tradition as the three yanas. So I'd like to begin just looking at the title of this book. It's online and it's a PDF. So I actually typed it because this was a little hard to get. So it's called Traveling from Confusion to Original Sanity. And I think if you really think about this title, in a way it says it all. So if you keep that in mind, this is a view of where we're going. So it's talking about starting from seeing the world in, you could say, through veils or confusion, and moving towards sanity and a deeper understanding of the way things really are, which would be original sanity. So don't worry if that made no sense. We're going to be talking about these things. And in fact, you may have found the chapter quite difficult if you read it, or maybe you understood it. But we're going to really be working with these concepts for quite a while and keep revisiting things. So just get what you get and don't worry about it. So this book is by, this material is by Dzogchen Panlop Rinpoche, and he teaches within the Nyingma tradition. And this is called the Ancient School in Tibet. We talked about that. Came into Tibet around the 8th century or so. I'm wondering, I also wanted to just bring up the visit of Anam Thubten. He was here last weekend. How many people actually got to go to see him? Yeah, quite a few. And others that aren't here were there. I think we had around 15 people or so. So I'm curious to hear from people what they thought. He is also within the Nyingma lineage and similar to Panlop Rinpoche. So again, his teachings are about resting in the natural state of mind. And he talked about Buddha nature as our original nature. So just curious to hear if people have any comments in terms of that teaching, because if this was your first time seeing a Tibetan teacher or a teacher, what you thought.
Mm-hmm. It was quite interesting, and I told it to him after I mentioned to him after the talk that it was interesting to see him on the big screen before,
uh-huh.
and then actually see him in life. It was just really, It was awesome. I loved the part where it was silent for about 5 minutes before, and the 5 minutes at the end, but also the chanting was awesome. And the other thing that really stuck with me was, the path, but also the whole thing about the metaphor with taking a shower. Mm-hmm. The shower thing with, about meditation, that's like what it is, because you can be, like you, the same being dirty and all that, and not taking a shower, smelly and everything, Now meditation just helps to kind of cleanse things away a little bit, so it's a really nice way of thinking about it.
Anybody else? See, most people weren't there during the whole weekend. Suzanne came, and also Janet was there. So you were speaking about the Friday night.
Right, Friday night.
The Friday night was a public talk. Yeah?
I felt that, it is a very strong presence. Mm-hmm. And my husband was with me, and he doesn't do any meditation or anything like that. And he was rather taken by it as well. He really felt, wow. I've never seen a speaker like that before. Mm-hmm. And couldn't believe somebody could just sit there and speak without using their hands. Mm-hmm. It never occurred to me that
way.
Oh, right. he didn't use his hands. He didn't have, his face was totally calm and no wrinkles. I mean, it just was, so he actually had a better description of it than I did, because I've experienced that kind of talk before and forgot that it's so different from when you go to hear like motivational speaker.
Right.
Yeah. And he's a totally motivational speaker in a different way. And what was interesting, telling a friend of mine about it, and I was so drawn in, and you just sit in somebody's presence like that, or when you even go to a meditation weekend or a retreat, you feel really open. And I'm sorry I couldn't do the whole weekend. But I walked away feeling it. Oh, I can do this. The next day it was 180 degrees. Everything was just, I was awful. I was judgmental. I was cranky. I was impatient. Everything. And I couldn't believe it. I don't know why. It was something strange.
Mm. But you noticed. So that, yeah, it was clear.
Yeah,
some
it was
clarity.
Clear.
Yeah. Suzanne, do you have any comments?
I really enjoyed it. I got a chance to do it on Sunday all day and half day on Saturday. He's funny. He goes, when you go home on Saturdays, when you go home, you're going to wonder what you learned today. And that's exactly what I did. Yeah. And then on the next day, on Sunday, he gave a talk about the ego. But he's talking, this is a funny story. He's talking, goes, there's the Tibetan eagle, and there's the
eagle.
American eagle. And then he's going, I had so much trouble with the accent. And he's talking about the female ego. But he was saying ego. And I spent the whole time going, what's he talking about eagles for?
Yeah, some of the words were really difficult to get.
But I thought he was very profound in a lot of what he said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, well, good. Yeah, I think when teachers come, if you have a chance to see them, our objective here is to let you know when people are coming to town and encourage you to go and see them. On our website under resources, there's a list of a lot of different teachers, and click through links to their websites. So those are all people we've met and studied with, or at least all of us, somebody in the group has studied with that person. All right, so let's move on. So tonight we're going to look at this text, the first chapter. And the first chapter is called The Path is the Goal. I wondered if anyone had any comments about that or an understanding of what that might mean. The path is the goal. Rather strange thing to say. Although it's an important Buddhist view. Mary? That was the raised eyebrow look. Watch those.
Well, because I've experienced this myself at different times, and thinking that the goal is enlightenment, and it that being a difficult thing to get your head around, and I just found that created, maybe in a good way, a craving. Initially, it's a good thing to crave that if you're going to crave anything. But it ends up, for me, it ended up creating some amount of conflict because it wasn't about every step. It became about this thing out there, mm-hmm. out there. So readjusting in the path and every moment, mm-hmm. taking it in, living it, opening your heart, that seems to be a better fit for me now mm-hmm. than it used to be.
That's a good description.
Yeah, one of Trungpa Rinpoche's titles for one of his books, which parallels that, is Journey Without Goal. Mm-hmm. So you understand goal is intrinsic to our nature. Our enlightened nature is intrinsic to ourselves. It's innate. It's something we already have. It's not something we're going to get from somewhere else. But in some sense, the goal is the path itself. And the path is the goal simultaneously. So the important thing is to be engaged, because when we're engaged, we're willing to be present and work with the moment as it is. We're really interested in reality. There's really nothing more interesting, finally.
And also thinking that the goal is out there and you're looking for something out there, it becomes spiritual materialism, because it turns into a materialistic quest in a way, even though we think it's spiritual. Because we want something, but actually the key here is dropping the we and letting go of that desire. So that's why the path is actually stressed, that it's really, that journey is really important. So I actually wanted, I just happened to find this today. I just opened, you know how sometimes you just open the book and... this book is called The Path of Individual Liberation, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, Our Teacher. It's volume one of The Profound Treasury of the Ocean of Dharma. And they were seminaries that he taught over a period of many years, and these were all compiled into three volumes. So this is the Hinayana that we're talking about, which is The Path of Individual Liberation. On the journey, you are not going anywhere. At the same time, you are going completely. You take a journey in order to realize that you are not going anywhere. On the way, you are shedding your ego, trying to surrender it completely. But when you reach the final destination, you realize that you have returned back home. You have gone in circles and come back to square one. You started from your home ground, samsara, which is confusion, basically the cycle of suffering and confusion, and your journey has taken you back to that home ground. But that home has suddenly changed its name to enlightenment. That is the journey we are trying to make. It is the journey itself that is important. Does that make sense to anyone? Yeah, I think it's well said. That was good. Okay. So again, the paradox here, I think James mentioned this at one point, the paradox about we want to get somewhere, which we think is enlightenment, and that wanting is in the way of actually getting there. And so the only way to get there is to drop it and just be in the moment, you could say. And that's really the paradox, I think. You have some ambition, but you have to really flip that around. So now I wanted to talk about the way this is laid out in terms of the material in class one. It's ground, path, and fruition. And this is a classic way of presenting material. So you... don't usually see a talk laid out as clearly as this, but usually you can find it within the talk. So I think this is really helpful because it's actually laid out. So ground is our starting place. So it's really the foundation or the bigger picture, you could say, also. The path is the way we travel. It can be the means of travel and the road and also the destination. That's the path. And the fruition is the result of action taken. So one example from sort of the common way of speaking would be building a house. So if you're going to build a house, first you have to have literally the ground, the site. Then you have to get the permits and do the design, assemble all the materials. That's kind of the beginning of the process. The path is the order of construction, digging the foundation and putting up the, you know, having concrete in the basement and putting up the walls, etc., and the way of constructing. And the fruition is the completion of the house and moving in, and maybe the landscaping is sort of the last thing. So there's a natural view here. So that outline is a helpful guideline in terms of understanding materials. So you can take that with you to other things that you look at or other books you're reading too. So let's begin with the ground. Pungpa Rinpoche says that the ground is Buddha nature. We talked about this a little bit in our earlier course on Mahayana, but let's look at this again. And I wanted to just read the beginning of the text here. Okay. Does anyone have the text with them?
Yeah.
Okay. Would someone like to read the beginning up to just the first paragraph? That would be great. Linda, do you want to?
The basic purpose?
Oh, the text itself.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, yes.
The basic purpose of doing meditation practice is to develop greater mindfulness and awareness, and through this to discover, or rather rediscover, our basic wisdom, in order to transcend our conflicting emotions. The reason we say rediscover is that this wisdom is already there. It already exists as a part of our mind, as the very nature of our mind. It is not something new that we are learning from this spiritual journey. Therefore, on this meditation path, we try to develop the ultimate realization through developing greater mindfulness and awareness. We try to go beyond just the mental chatter on the surface of our mind and get to know its deeper levels. Gradually, we familiarize ourselves with the full scope of our mind so that we finally realize its ultimate nature. In the Buddhist view, the ultimate nature of our mind is the nature of a Buddha's wisdom, a Buddha's heart. The nature of our mind is always enlightened, always awakened. It is vital to have firm confidence that the basic nature of our own mind has the same nature as the wisdom of a Buddha. With that confidence, we familiarize ourselves with the nature of our mind in order to directly and fully experience it.
So what do you think about that? What is that all about?
For me, it sounds like it's just, it's innate, it's inside of us, and that there are things that kind of keep us from being in the moment. That it's interesting, too, to, you know, just to think of the analogy of, you know, the house and the foundation, that thinking that this is the foundation to build upon, and But all the materials are already here. We don't have to go to the store and go get the materials.
Right. Right. So he's saying really that that nature is within everyone. So it's basic, you could say basic goodness within every person. So that's the fundamental view when you take it from that point of view, from this particular way of looking at it. That's the bigger picture.
I'm beginning to wonder about the use of the word mind in that sense. Is the basic nature mind? Does it have thoughts that are different from the ones I'm thinking when I'm meditating, or is it really something else?
Well, it's the wisdom aspect, the wisdom mind, and the thoughts they can be confused. We're going to be talking more about what covers the mind. In fact, that's the next section, actually. And so it's not confused, that basic nature. But we actually, this is the path that we're going to work with here, is understanding what covers over that fundamental basic nature.
Right.
And one thing, the last two chapters in this book, we're not going to take that, you know, yet. But that starts with emotions. It talks about emotions and how emotions hook us and confuse us. But the actual, there's a wisdom aspect to those emotions as well. So there's different ways we get confused and cover over our basic nature. And one of those is a belief, a solid belief in self, which needs to be protected, defended, whatever. Yes, Jan.
I mean, I get all of that. I guess where I get kind of confused is I never looked at like our true nature as being part of our mind.
That's
right. And I think, yeah. Is that what you were getting
yeah,
at?
Right.
I look at it more, pardon my belly, or in a different location, I guess. It doesn't seem to be.
But remember, mind is mind heart. So it's a little.
Yeah, it's semantics.
Well, it's not intellect.
In English, we have this difficulty.
We have problems.
We have this
with
one
English.
Word called mind.
Right.
If you go into other languages, even European languages, but certainly in Tibetan, there are several words to describe the various aspects we're discussing. But the simplest way to understand this on one level is mind and mind essence. Or, in other words, everything we are is mind, which is the basis. We can't experience anything that is not mind. On the other hand, there's confused mind and there is sane mind, there is wisdom mind. So mind essence is still mind, but it's core, it's the core essence. It's like if we say our heart is not just this pumping muscle, but when we don't point here when we say heart, we point here when we think about heart. And we're talking about something more essential than just a beating muscle in our body. We're talking about some kind of core of our own being.
But my fantasy or whatever it is, my thought is that this mind essence is an automatic thing, the way your heart beating is. If I could only get to it.
Automatic.
It exists without. You mean?
You mean it's self-existing.
It's self-existing.
Yeah.
It's self-existing.
Right.
We use the
yeah.
term self-existing.
Right.
It's there
okay.
without being. Created or manufactured
right.
or
right.
absolutely it's primordial.
Can't be, yeah,
that's
destroyed.
One of the things Anam Tripton mentioned about primordial.
Primordial. Right. Adam?
Is it a matter of like finding your own perspective? As in, like, we all have individual perspectives as individuals. Mm-hmm. If we all have the ability to see things differently, and that's the part of us that gets clouded over by, you know, samsara, just. Is that what we're trying to find, is a way to direct our mind towards the world around us in a way that sees, you know, so that things can appear to us as purely as they possibly can?
What would you say to that question?
We in Buddhism, we don't focus on individuality. This is something that we actually learn is sort of part of our problem. And we're not trying to get rid of being an individual, but we're learning about what it means to be fundamentally true. And an individual has opinions and defines himself, at least in our culture, by the opinions they have, and you know, which is subject to change and which is subject to being influenced by other people's opinions. If you just think about often the things that are attached to the word individual. So, but we are talking about some fundamental basic integrity, if you can think of it like that. That, again, it's just fundamentally indigenous to ourselves. It's what we have, whether we get it or not, is still there. It's a pure potential from the general point of view. Pure potential.
Okay, but as much as like individuality has so much attached to it, so does the idea of like an absolute reality.
Right.
We're
not talking about anything being attached to anything.
Right.
We're talking about going beyond all those. In fact, we even go beyond concepts.
Right.
So
that's
we're using these concepts to start to discuss about what's beyond concept.
It helps me to think of the heart mind thing.
Right, because we separate out mind here, heart, like emotion here, right? But this is actually a joining of the mind and heart, and it's a different view. Someone had a hand up? Yeah.
For me, we talked before about the gap.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, the experience of that is, it's like thought, and whatever, whenever you can kind of rest in between in a gap, it's like the light switch goes on.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about, you know, I'm hungry, I hate that person, you know, I gotta get going, and if the gap gets wider for me, then there's all this light and all this space and all this, it's resting in something that has the ability to feel wisdom and to feel heart and to feel genuine and to feel natural. So to me, my thinking is if I can widen my gaps,
mm-hmm.
then I have more potential to rest in that wisdom, and then the so-called thinking mind, I know we're using all these terms,
mm-hmm.
but the thinking mind doesn't have its power over me.
Mm-hmm.
Does that
mm-hmm.
make sense?
Mm-hmm. Do you have the text there?
Yeah.
Can you read the next paragraph? Because
okay.
it's exactly what you said.
Oh.
Yeah,
okay.
There you go.
Right. What is the nature of our mind, as Mary said?
Very good.
The basic state of our mind is pure and free from all kinds of bondage and hang-ups that tie us down right now. It is an open, spacious, awareness of vivid experience of being wide awake without center or fringe, as boundless as the sky, without any trace of confusion or pain. Though there is nothing to hold on to in this luminous vast expanse, it is pervaded by the unconditional wisdom, compassion, and joy. This fundamental ground is the true nature of all living beings from the very start of their existence.
You want to continue that? I think that continues.
Just one more sentence.
Buddhism does not speak about primordial, thank you, sin, but rather about our primordial purity and goodness free from all evil and the self-centered views of ego.
How's that sound?
Does that help with your question?
Makes you feel more
yeah.
Yeah,
sure.
Good.
So refreshing after, you know, growing up as a Christian, being told that we're simple.
Right, it's a different, it's taking it from a different point of view. Totally.
Yeah.
Yes. I'm glad you brought that up. Okay. So why don't we experience this Buddha nature all the time? What is it that prevents us from experiencing this moment by moment all the time.
You mean you don't?
I hope you're not disappointed if I say no, I don't experience it constantly.
We're so busy being aggravated with the person who's driving too slow in front of us, or worrying about, you know, what should we have for lunch, that we don't make the space and time.
So it's so we get caught in our in our emotions, in our anger, or whatever these, it's whatever it is that hooks us, takes us away from that possibility of being in that open, spacious place.
But
yes?
I don't think you can talk about what gets you hooked without recognizing that we are social beings and we live in. Live in a society that we need to work in and raise families in, or whatever it is we do, we're always interacting.
Yeah.
And so through all of the interactions and the things that we need to do in order to take care of ourselves, it's through all of that that we just lose track of.
That's exactly the point. You could actually be awake during all of those things and and available without shutting down because of whatever this one said. Or when you think about Anam Tupten, it's very interesting. Mm-hmm. He's married. He has, I think, 2 children. So he has a life, and he has, I'm sure, a lot of things come up. But it's interesting when you see someone who's resting in that space. I would imagine, and actually, I would imagine that he actually is able to be with whatever's happening without shutting down or pushing it away. Or.
But much of our interactive behaviors learned. We're raised as young children by our parents. We're taught in schools. And so begins our learning how to approach living in the world. A lot of it is just being human, I would say. And not that it doesn't get in the way, but still it's. I guess I struggled with this next paragraph.
Yes,
you know, I told you.
I know, you did. You said the garbage.
You're your sin, but you're comparing us to our minds to medieval toilets and filth and garbage. I mean, you know, come on. I'm just being human. I'm doing a lot of what I was raised to do, you know.
And you're saying that that's good.
No, I'm just saying that that's just that kind of coming down.
It's just the human condition. All of this. Everything you're saying is true. From the get-go, we're bombarded with other people telling us how it is and informing our minds and shaping our minds. Mm-hmm. Our environments are shaping our minds.
Right.
Our friends are shaping our minds.
Exactly.
Our experiences themselves are coming back and forming and shaping our minds and notions of ourselves and who we are and what we are. So there is an unlearning process.
Exactly.
Right. Meditation.
I guess I'm trying to say, don't let people be too hard on themselves. Like, oh my God, I'm in traffic and I'm angry at the person in front of me. Well, yeah, that's part of living. It happens.
But it doesn't
have to. Right.
But then you can notice it. That's the point.
Right. Exactly.
And meditation gives
you
the gap to notice. Yes. Go ahead.
So, my understanding is that meditation helps you to make a choice. Opposed to reacting in life. Whatever happens, you know, we just react, opposed to being mindful and saying, you know what, I could react that way, or I could do something else.
It's unlearning.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
A lot of unlearning.
Mm-hmm. It is, and that's what it is. It's stripping away the layers. And this is the image of the cocoon, which I think is absolutely great, the way he described the cocoon. the starting point where we fix the first thread of this cocoon is called me, and is the center of our world. From there, we keep spinning our threads to include others. We crisscross many times between these two points, self and other, solidifying our world through subject, object, inside, outside, good, bad, and so on. Finally, we convince ourselves of the true existence of our magnificent cocoon to such a degree that we feel it is the most natural thing in the world. We cling to it for dear life, believing it is who we are. We have completely lost track of where we started our threads, as well as the fact that this construction is entirely homespun. We become attracted to those threads that seem to affirm and comfort us, and feel aversion toward those who seem to be threatening and unpleasant. As a result, we respond to these feelings of comfort and aversion by trying to obtain or keep what we like and avoid or get rid of what we don't like. This behavior results in our experience of various kinds of fleeting happiness and suffering. So that's a thumbnail, kind of condensed version of what we're going to be working on, and we're going to be moving towards understanding suffering and what creates suffering. So that's where we're heading. That's the second chapter, whenever we get there. Might be a while, but I don't care how long it takes. It's not about time.
And what relationship did you describe the vehicles?
The vehicles, right. So I...
You said we would be studying...
So the hinayana,
trying to develop, what relationship does that have to it?
Very good. That's a great question. So the hinayana is the path of individual liberation. So we start by understanding how we create our world of suffering and why we're unhappy, basically. And now some people will say, well, I'm not really suffering. Okay, well, just look a little bit further out, and there's plenty of suffering to look at. And maybe you don't personally experience that level of suffering as somebody in Syria or whatever, but you can understand it. So the Hinayana path is really understanding how we're lost in confusion and how we create a world based on ego and holding on to our concepts, our views. You know, you could say, okay, I'm a religious person and my religion's better than yours, or whatever it is that we set up as our definitions that we hold on to. So individual liberation is cutting through a lot of these solidifications of the cocoon, all these threads that we weave where we create something that's very fixed. And this is the layers of the garbage around the jewel. That's the image. The jewel is the Buddha nature, and we've created a world around that. So the path of individual liberation is stripping away these veils or understanding what it is that keeps us spinning around in our own, you know, confusion or suffering. And we're going to be looking at all the factors. We're going to take it apart bit by bit. And that's going through this path of the Four Noble Truths. And that's the beginning teachings of the Buddha. So the Buddha, we've told a little bit about the story of the Buddha. I won't go into the whole story, but I'll go through get to the end. So he tried a lot of different practices, ascetic practices in India, you know, basically starving himself and whatever. And then he actually took some food and he decided he was going to sit under this tree until he attained liberation. And this is what he did. He sat there until he really penetrated through to the truth of reality. And what he saw was so profound and so vast that he felt he couldn't really tell anybody about it, so he was never going to teach. He thought no one would ever understand what I saw. And he then started teaching, because he was asked to, from the point of view of where people were. And he looked out there, and people were suffering. They were suffering. They didn't have enough food. They were angry. They were killing each other, whatever. He saw so much suffering. And he started talking from that point of view, which is the relative truth. He talked about that. And that was the first teaching he gave, was the Four Noble Truths. So it was about suffering. And that's where people, that's how people experience their world. He started from there. But he also went on to teach the ultimate truth, which is the Buddha nature and
is the nature of reality, emptiness.
Emptiness.
And then the third is the turning of wheel, is actual the nature of Buddha mind, nature of enlightened mind itself.
Right.
So those three turnings reflect those three various, those three yanas, what we call them.
Right,
the basic
that's a good
path.
Way. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you want to say that again?
Yeah.
I think just repeat what you just said about the turnings and how they relate to the path.
So the first turning of the wheel is about fundamentally understanding the basis for confusion, and so this and suffering. The basis of suffering we will be exploring to find that it's not just about all these people out there who are experiencing enormous grief and terror, and we're talking about the confusion every single person has. And this confusion is suffering. It's not to be confused with pain. If you have a body, you're going to have pain. You're going to experience pain. We're not talking about getting rid of all pain. This is not a snake oil kind of thing. So understanding suffering is actually the way of engaging onto the path. And by engaging on the path, there is a way out of the suffering. There is a way to deal with the suffering. And that is the path. Which is the third noble truth, and the fourth noble truth is fundamental peace, liberation. So the first school, having to do with self-liberation, is based on that teaching, the four noble truths. Then the second turning of the wheel is the nature of emptiness, the nature of ultimate reality itself, which is not simply lack of ego, no ego alone, but no ego in anything, as we say, egolessness of dharmas. Everything itself is completely open and unencumbered in its own nature, and completely beyond the nature of grasping itself. This is rather inconceivable, it's very profound, but it's also the basis of what we call the Mahayana path, the great path. And so we realize we're not just here to simply work on ourselves alone. It translates in terms, because once we actually discover and get a glimpse even of what this reality is, we realize that our motivation is to be here for everybody and everything. That's the Mahayana path. We work for the benefit of all beings. So even when we work on ourselves, our own personal liberation, we are actually working for the benefit of all beings with that motivation. The motivation deepens and becomes much vaster. Then, the final nature is that that's not just it. It's just also what do we actually understand, what the reality of the nature of our wisdom mind is, which is awareness itself, and how we actually develop. And to do that, we enter the Vajrayana, which is a more accelerated method of achieving enlightenment. So when people talk about achieving enlightenment one time, it's basically because they employ what's understood as the Vajrayana realizations. It just expedites everything, and it's far more complete, and it doesn't rely on taking 10 million years to sort of start to let these insights dawn on us. Is that how, is that sufficient for the moment?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. So we're still really in the introductory phase here to look at the bigger picture, and we're going to keep going down deeper and deeper so that you have a deeper understanding.
I do have a question.
Yeah.
The Four Noble Truths are all part of the first turning.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So let's move on to the path. What is the path in this case? He talks about getting to know our own mind, how mind functions, what emotions are arising and how we deal with them. And he talks about exploring without fear. In other words, when things come up, could be in our meditation or else other times, to really look at what's happening without fear and have an inquisitive mind. So the path is really uncovering the Buddha nature by looking at our own mind. And he says it's a journey inward. So that's the only way to really understand this, is this journey inward. So on, well, let's see, you don't have pages, the same as I do, but I'll read this. When we start, let's see, this is under the path, the journey happens within. When we start on this path, we may think that the ultimate ground of our mind's true state is unconnected to our ordinary reality. That is, our conventional, unquestioned experience of ourselves and the world. However, in order to approach and realize ultimate reality, we need to fully understand relative reality. We cannot simply say, I've had enough of my ordinary world of concepts, upsetting emotions, and suffering. I am ready to jump into my true nature. That's, well, good idea. No matter how many enthusiastic descriptions of the breathtaking view from the top of Mount Everest we may hear from others, no matter how much we wish to be up there, there is no way to enjoy that view unless we know and properly use the means to climb this mountain. In other words, properly understanding and then seeing through the confusion in our relative reality is the means to see ultimate reality. Thus, the starting point of the Buddha's path consists of becoming familiar with these two levels of reality, what seems to be the case in the world as we know it, and how things actually are. So this is something we're going to be coming back to over and over again.
I'm just a little hung up on the part about seeing things as they actually are, and it just goes back to the, you know, being an individual, like how is that attainable in any way, and doesn't that sort of lead to its own form of attachment? Isn't that kind of a goal, like seeing things as they actually are?
Not particularly a goal. It's what happens. So the image is often of the sun, and the sun is just there. It's there. It shines. And if it's a cloudy day, and as it's been in the last couple days, you may not think about the sun, or you may not know that the sun is there. But those clouds eventually will pass away, and the sun has always been there, and it's always shining. And so there's then the realization that it's actually the clouds that are obscuring it. So the view is that our confusion is what's covering over that perception of what's really there.
But we're still locked into this one subjective, subjective view of things. And, you know, even if I see the sun, how do I know it's really there, if there isn't something even bigger behind it? Or if somebody else sees the sun and we both agree that we see the sun, okay, that's two perspectives.
But this is all speculative.
Yeah.
We're talking about learning something directly through our own direct experience. This is what has to be the confirming factor. If we don't understand things directly through our experience, we can't possibly know. So when we go into these hypothetical situations where somebody else may be living in a completely different cosmos and has, you know, entirely different perceptions, it has no relevance to the fact that I have to cope with what I'm working with right now. We're working with this first. We're not going to take on everything else simultaneously.
And nobody can show it to you. That's the point. You know, that's what the Buddha saw. I don't know how I would ever show this to anybody. This is the most fundamental truth. I can't show anyone. And he said that. I can't tell you how to do this. You have to find it on your own. And I'll mention something you might want to get out of the library, and it's, I think it might even be in the children's section, I don't know. I just blanked out what it is. It's called The Mind's Eye, I think. And I think it's called The Mind's Eye. Has anyone heard about that? I don't know if I have the right title. But basically, it's pictures within pictures. So you look at the what's obviously there, and then at a point your eyes relax. Key point: your eyes relax, and all of a sudden there's another picture underneath that pops out. The Magic Eye. It's called The Magic Eye.
That's right.
So if you get that book. It's actually showing, I mean, it's all analogies. There's no way anyone can tell you. But all of a sudden, you're just looking at this picture and then boom, you know, something else comes out of it. And so we're talking here about relative reality and ultimate reality.
Okay, so it's not like about an absolute concrete reality so much as having things appear to us as in the purest way that they can.
That happens, but at the same time, as we're working it simultaneously, what we're doing in our meditation right now, for instance, what we did tonight, our basic meditation instruction is teaching us how to learn how to settle our mind. It's called shamatha, or calm abiding, and it has to do with letting our mind settle so that we actually have the capacity to perform the act of seeing directly how our mind is working. That's the next step, and it will happen very naturally if you do these practices on your own as you engage more and more and build them into your life. This will occur spontaneously, but, you know, we'll be discussing this as well as we go forward. That's called vipassana, or clear seeing. Tibetan word is hlak tong, and it basically means clear seeing. So the vipassana is something that it actually occurs all the time without our knowing it. But it's clear perception, which is not clouded by opinions and bias. So by working through the first practice of learning how to tame our minds so that we're not constantly injecting and projecting issues into what's there, we begin to actually relax with that, and we're actually open to what actually arises in our perception as something direct. Is this helpful?
Yeah, it's putting trust in your senses then.
Yeah, we're going to go into the next... The part of your question hinges on the next topic, which is called view meditation and action, which we'll get to.
So we'll do that next week. So we'll still be on the same chapter, but you're welcome to read the following chapter if you want, and just keep going over this and contemplating it. That's another aspect of how to learn. So as you can see, we're going into much deeper material than we've done before. So it takes more effort to really bring up those questions, ask yourself those questions, answer them, or talk to each other, or whatever, and continue your meditation practice. The most important thing is your daily meditation practice. Without that, all of this is concept and therefore garbage, because it doesn't mean anything, because you can't really get it through words. So we're going to spend time talking, and you can't get it through words. There you go. What else can I say? This is a tough job. So just bring your paper, you know, if this is helpful, bring it back next week. I won't print out 100 copies again. So just bring it back, and if you print out your PDF offline, you know, online, just print it out, bring it with you, mark it up, whatever. Really work with the material. This is, it's difficult, but we know it is.
And bring your questions.
Bring your questions, yeah. Bring your questions. Okay, so I think we will pass out the dedication of merit.